Welcome to another exciting episode, we hope, of the Star Trek Discovery podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
And tonight, we are here to discuss the mid-season finale, or what they call the fall finale. I don't know what the difference is, but it is titled, Into the Forest I Go, Season 1, Episode 9. Written by executive story editors Bo-Young Kim and Erica Lippold, and directed by Chris Byrne. Okay, so we don't have much in this section tonight, but we do have one thing of news, so let's make a shipwide announcement. Well, the main bit of news is that we finally know when Star Trek Discovery returns. We've known it's going to be in January, but now we know it is January 7th, which is kind of cool because that's day after my birthday. So, but I'm very happy about this because A, it's not a huge long wait. There's a couple of months, I guess, but it's good. And for selfish reasons, I also love it because this means, unlike this past half season, when it comes back, there's only one intersection with The Walking Dead. So it might be a little less stressful for me.
Yeah, double duty gets to be a little bit difficult after a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I guess we should explain, we're recording we're recording a day later tonight, and because of the other podcast, my co-host has resigned, so I am basically doing the rest of the half season with guest hosts, which so far the first one we recorded turned out really well, but it's a little more work getting everything together and organizing it all, so I'm kind of glad in a way that this is the last episode of the first half, because I will get a little bit of a break.
Well, with the holidays coming up and everything too, I'm sure we've got other things going on, and so do our listeners.
Yeah. Yeah, and for that matter, I think that this particular episode was a good one to end with. So with that, not terrible segue, what did you think of episode 9, Into the Forest I Go?
Well, I gave it 8 this week, actually. I decided to give it a grand total of 8 ludicrously bright beacons. Thought it was a good episode. I had a couple issues with it, but nothing out of the ordinary for a Star Trek show.
Fantastic. Well, I love this episode. I don't think it was perfect, but I definitely think it was the best that we've had so far by a landslide. So I'm going to give it a very high mark of 9.75. Mostly redeemed specialist and, I guess, former first officers.
Wow, you really gave that thing a high rating.
I loved it.
Okay, so you knocked off a quarter point.
I think I knocked off a quarter point because that's a good question. I think just some of the underlying things I'm still, having to ask a question of, like, for example, Stamets, why is he the only pilot? And the other thing is, I kept thinking of the first Lethal Weapon. Murtaugh.
Oh yeah.
Doing that, this is the last case before I retire.
It really felt that way, didn't it?
It did. It did. It was very tropey. And you just know, just like, you know, it was with Murtaugh, it's not going to be his last, and will also turn out very badly. So yeah, I guess it was for that, because it was so obvious that it was a bad idea. And also, you know, that statement's kind of like, Lorca didn't ask him to do it, but because he didn't ask him to do it, that kind of made Stamets want to do it. And I'm thinking to myself, why do they have to spore drive into Starbase 46? I mean, can't they just go there on maximum warp?
Yeah, it was 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, that was a little weak.
That's one of the things that knocked it down for me too, because at first viewing, it just seemed like, okay, we use the spore drive now, and, you know, what's one more jump? But then I realized, wait a minute, this isn't like Voyager or something where they've got light years to travel. It's 3 hours.
Yeah, a 3 hour tour. A 3 hour tour.
Yeah, so what all went right for you then? Because you gave it, you know, such a high score. You must have loved a lot of things in this episode.
I thought that, you know, the arc of Burnham, you know, destroying the ship of the dead, how that, you know, there were some kind of tropey things that I kind of, you know, rolled my eyes over, but it wasn't enough to mark down, you know, like noisy sensors, things like that. It's like, wouldn't you try to like make them a little less obvious? Okay, maybe 9.6. All right, I talked myself into marking that part down a little bit more. So 9.6, still a very high mark. I'll keep doing that until I'm done, and it'll end up an 8. But no, well,
at least everybody knows this show is organic. Like, we discuss things a little bit beforehand, but it pretty much all comes out on air. And I love it when we change our ratings just based on the conversations that we have.
I know it's. But it's real that this is how people think and how people interact with, you know, stuff. So I think it is real, unscripted. But yeah, I thought it was a fantastic episode overall. Very tense. I love the fact that we finally saw Tyler snap, because he had it coming. You know, love the fact that they found Cornwell, that they were able to recover her. Just, I thought the whole, you know, 133 micro jumps were phenomenal too. I just thought the whole darn thing was really great. And unlike last week, it wasn't too short. It was actually a nice length this time, so didn't feel over edited to me.
Yeah, agreed.
Yes. Yeah, so I loved it, but what did other people think?
Well, quick spoiler for later in the episode, we had a new bit of feedback from listener Monofescu, who gave it 0 and 0 and 0 out of 5, 5 and 5. And when we get into listener feedback later on, we'll hear all of his reasons for that one. What about Rick from Cleveland there, Brian?
Yeah, we got some non-standard ratings. Rick from Cleveland, he says, this week's episode rates 133 out of 134 rapid-fire spore jumps.
That's right up there with Mark's rating from... The time loop episode. Sorry, I'm blanking on the show title right now.
Yeah, that was magic to make the sanest man go mad.
That's the one. Yeah. Well, Maury also gave it a high mark. Maury Esterbrook said he gives this episode 9 Georgiou toothpicks out of 10.
Yeah, that was actually pretty funny in a way, and made me glad once he was dead. Stefan said he didn't like it as much. He gave it a 7 out of 10, destroyed ships of death, and he says it feels like a fair rating.
Okay. All right. Well, Mark backs you up as well. He gives it 9. I spy with my little eye a Klingon ship that's cloaked.
And if someone backs you up based on the fact that they gave the same mark, Fred from the Netherlands gives it 8 out of 10 interspecies sex scenes.
Yeah, we were definitely on the same page with this one. I had to rename my rating system because he used the same metric as I did. Yeah. That was not something I expected. We got our profanity. I didn't realize that the threat of nudity would come from the aliens.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that later, I think, that whole thing, because it's a little more than that. It wasn't just Klingon booby. It was Klingon rapey. So not something that was a nervous laugh. That wasn't something to laugh about, because I think it's a pretty serious issue, especially with all the things out there right now with the sexual harassment stuff. So something to, discuss, I think. All right. Well, anyway, that's it for our ratings tonight. So we have our yeses.
Yes.
And I believe I didn't get to read or listen to all of Fred's feedback. So he might have had some yeses and nos in his feedback. But the only yeses and nos that we got were from Mark in his voicemail. So it's just us to discuss those things. Why don't you start with your first one?
Sure. The first one that I had definitely was the warp drive straight into the spore jump. That was such a cool visual.
That was totally unexpected, and I have to 100% agree with you. I kind of went, oh my God, when they did, because I didn't think that could even happen, you know, right out of subspace, you know, right out of, in the middle of traveling at warp, you don't even have to stop. You go straight into spore drive, you know?
Yeah, I was with you. I thought you'd have to shut one down in order to use the other.
Guess not.
Nope.
Well, my first yes I have to give it to Burnham getting back that Georgiou toothpick. You know, she says, you know, this isn't yours. And anyway, I really enjoyed that whole fight scene and, pretty much everything that happened on the ship of the dead. With the exception of those sensors, which I thought were so goofy.
Yeah. Yeah. That fight scene was really well done. And they even made point of it on After Trek that they actually considered the logistics of it in that basically all Burnham could really do was evade. Instead of trying to hold her own and throw, you know, punch for punch with a angry Klingon. Finally, they get some actual, you know, logic into the fight scenes. I'm glad that the writers actually consider those points for a change.
Yeah. All right. What's your next one?
My next one was actually, I have to make this one a hybrid, actually. I meant to put it in both sections, but I only put it in one. Tyler's PTSD. I loved that. I'll give it a yes for this. That it actually exists. You know, the character actually has consequences from events that happened in his past instead of, you know, most times these things, they just kind of get swept under the rug because it moves the story forward better if the characters don't actually feel the effects of everything that they go through. Because let's face it, I mean, it's a drama series. And if people were reacting normally and naturally to all the things that take place to these people, they'd all be nervous wrecks.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see that there's at least some recognition that some of the things that these characters go through can have lasting effects for a change.
Yeah. Well, you should probably put that in your nose because this one is a yes and a no. So my second yes is an effective use of the universal translator. I think a lot of people. I hadn't really expressed it too much, but I would definitely say myself included, were a little tired of all of the Klingon stuff being in Klingon and having to read the subtitles. I was good with a lot of it, but it was just so much of it that way. And for them to finally use the universal translator in a way that made it seem very natural and useful, I thought was really good. However, I do have issues with it that I'll discuss in a couple minutes in the news.
Well, I'll back you up on the universal translator, because the thing that I liked about the Klingon speech is that when there was no universal translator around, you had subtitles. And then as soon as there was a universal translator in the room, subtitles went away and we get English speaking Klingons. It actually made perfect sense. It was great.
Yeah.
Way better than we've seen in any other series so far.
Yeah, I 100% agree. 100% agree. All right, what's your next one?
I love the fact that Cornwell lived. They left it open in the last episode, and she's alive. I wonder, though, what do you think about this, Brian? Do you think she's going to get use of her legs back, or is she now going to be paralyzed?
Well, they did say, I think the Vulcan Admiral said that she would make a full recovery. I heard that.
Well, that would be kind of surprising, given that, well, Worf was a Klingon, but you know, he had that back injury, and the thought was it took an experimental medical procedure to fix his spinal injury. So if Cornwell can make a full recovery from having her back broken, that would be kind of out of canon, I think.
Well, I mean, we don't know the extent of her injury, so.
I just assumed she was paralyzed when she got slammed into the bulkhead.
Yeah. I guess Lorca would be my last yes. I don't know. In a lot of ways, I don't trust his motives still. And some of what he did seemed very, double-sided. But he was a very effective captain. And I love the fact that, you know, I saw him not just as an effective tactician, really motivated to defeat the Klingons, but he's also pretty darn smart too. And he knows how to influence people. I don't think that's necessarily a yes, but anyway, his character in this episode I thought was something to take note of.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. He might be my favorite on the show, actually. Whereas other captains were able to motivate their crew, like you said, he's able to more manipulate them. So he's much better at speaking to them in terms that get them to do what he wants instead of making them rise to the occasion, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's not just his crew. I mean, he did the same thing to Cornwell, too. I mean, this guy's a master. He should write books.
Yeah. No, he's very effective as a captain, but he has a very different way of going about things than what we've seen in other series.
Yeah.
So I think that's why he's so intriguing to me, is you never really know what his true motivations are. Like, there's still so many layers to him that they can just keep writing wrinkles in, and I'm happy with all of it.
Yeah, me too. Looks like you got one more.
Yep. I've got to shout out the 133. The mini spore jumps were super cool. Obviously the way it ended up for Stamets wasn't so great, but the use of the spore drive in such a way that you can just kind of hop around and be there one moment and gone the next, making it impossible to target the ship. That's a brilliant strategy.
Yeah. And I think they said on After Trek, there was a reason why they used 133. I remember what it was now. It was to honor the first episode of the Battlestar Galactica reboot, which was titled 33.
Mm-hmm.
And originally they were going to make, 525,600 jumps?
Some crazy high number, yeah. I want to know if there was any significance to that one, or if they were just really being ridiculous with the script at that point.
No, it has to do with the play Rent, the musical Rent, because both Wilson Cruz and
Anthony Rapp,
both starred in Rent. So I think it's $525,600. It could be $555,600. I don't know, but it's something like that. And yeah, that's part of one of the songs from that musical.
Okay. Yeah. They like to write in little stuff like that. I could see that going there. All right. Any more yeses for you, Brian?
No, that's it. Time for
no.
Or as Burnham would say, no! Good time to play that considering, mm-hmm. What she did on that same ship.
So I believe you're up first in our no section here, Brian. What did you have to write down here?
Well, it's a confusion that I had, and that is, okay, so it seems like they built some, you know, method of detecting the, you know, the Klingons and their cloaking device. But I did not understand, because the whole thing from the last episode was that they were going to use Pavo, you know, and its transmitter to detect the cloaking devices. And when they explained it in this episode, I heard nothing about them. And it was, they were just going back there to protect the Pavans. So did I miss something, or was the method that they found to detect them have nothing to do with the Pavans, or did it use the Pavan transmitter in some way that I didn't glean?
You know, I wish I could clear that up for you, but I don't know either. As far as I know, the beacons and the spore jumps were all their own method of detection. I think they were just going back to Pavo to defend them because they were basically pulled into something as an innocent third party. What was never clear to me was how they intended to actually use that transmitter in the first place. Was there some sort of interface for the ship's computer to work with? And would the transmitter reveal all the Klingon ships or just the ones in orbit around Pavo?
I don't know. I thought that the transmitter would detect all of them, which, you know, with when they say, you know, makes a sound or something, well, you know, sound only travels at about 700 miles an hour, at least on Earth. So that would take
through a vacuum.
Right. So that would take a long time to get out there. But that's from last week. So I didn't dock the episode too much for this, because within itself, it's the detection method made sense. In fact, I would say it made more sense than using the Pavan transmitter, but I just didn't understand how the Pavan transmitter fitted into it. So if anyone has any insight about that, please send us some feedback and we'll, you know, maybe talk about it next time we have an episode, whenever that will be.
Yeah, the whole involvement of the Pavans, I think, was limited to the invitation that they sent out to the Klingons to show up there. But maybe they were planning on playing some sort of a role. I think it was just kind of dropped overall because it wasn't really important to the story. My first no, we're going to talk about the Klingons some more. This is not exclusive to Star Trek.
Okay.
But it's the classic trope of I've cut through all the cables on the door. Now the door opens and unlocks. It's like, you know, when you want to break a computer, you shoot the monitor. It doesn't really work that way. But it works every time in the movies. That's how it works. You just smash the control panel and the whole device is broken.
Yeah, and how many times have they done that on Star Trek in the various versions of Star Trek? You know, I can think of that happening on Deep Space Nine and on Next Gen, and, you know, I'm sure Voyager, probably Enterprise, although I can't think of an example on Enterprise, but I'm pretty sure there was one on Enterprise too, and of course on TOS. So it's Star Trek likes this one.
Yeah, if you want to at least, like, I don't know, cut a couple of wires and like short circuit the door or something, you know, hot wire it, so to speak. Okay, but if all it takes is just pulling the panel off and cutting all the wires and the door opens, that's a pretty terrible door lock.
Yep.
All right, Brian, what else do you have?
Okay, well, I mentioned the Klingons and the use of the universal translator, but the thing that I didn't understand is Cole seemed to have no understanding or even recollection of anything, known as a universal translator, which is kind of funny because they did have universal translators, or at least rudimentary ones, in Enterprise. So it's like, are you telling me that the Klingons, who have been spacefaring long before humans were, they never came up with a universal translator? I didn't buy that. I didn't buy it at all, actually.
Yeah, it seemed a little out of place to me as well. I could see if the Klingons, because they're so proud and purist, that they might not see the need to develop such a technology.
Yeah.
But we've already seen it in Enterprise, so there's either a continuity gap there, or there's some additional explanation forthcoming that we don't yet know.
Yeah.
There's always that with this show. You notice that? Like, everything that goes against canon, we still hold our breath and say, well, they might explain it still.
Well, they have explained a lot of it, so I will give them that.
Yeah, based on the way this chapter wrapped up, there might be more explanations forthcoming. We just have to wait and see.
That we do. You got another one, I see.
Yeah, if we're going to be revisiting our yeses and turning them into nos, then this is a good time to mention Tyler's PTSD again. While I like the idea of addressing PTSD and putting it into the story, the fact that this is the first time it's come up, that is the thing that strains credulity. I mean, he gets off the ship with Lorca. Then he's engaging in simulations in the exact same battle that took place in his escape. That didn't trigger anything. All these other events have taken place. And yet now going back onto that ship is what finally sets him off.
I think Laurel was the one that set him off. I don't think it was just being on the ship.
You don't think something would have at least like hinted at it before now, though? Because remember, part of the thing that we thought was so odd was how easily and quickly he integrated back into Starfleet. That was one of our tells that he might be Vok. But apparently, no, that was just him getting along with life just fine after 7 months in a Klingon prison.
Party.
Yeah, right. He literally was the life of the party.
Yep, he was. Let's move on to our feedback, and we've got a nice long one here from Mark.
Hey, Brian. Hey, Adam. Mark from Ontario, Canada here. I give this episode 9, I Spy with My Little Eye, a Klingon Ship That's Cloaked. What a great way to end the first half of Star Trek Discovery's inaugural season. Not only did they destroy the leading threat to the Federation, but now they find themselves in another situation that will carry us into Chapter 2, and I can't wait. Now, I know I'm jumping right to the end here, but during that final jump, did you see the ship split into two as it was doing those flips, then come back together as it made the jump? Was that an indication that there is two ships? Maybe one jumped into a mirror universe where we saw our crew at the end? And maybe another one successfully made the jump to Starbase 46? I don't know, but I'm wondering if that split vision there has some significance. It's just too bad we have to wait so long to find out. Now, I really liked in this episode how Captain Lorca showed us just how intuitive he is and how much he actually does pay attention. I mentioned at the beginning of the season how I wasn't trusting him and I wasn't sure he was a good captain. Well, by this point, I'm really liking him as a character. Although I have to say, I don't understand his qualms about Burnham saying that the mission was too dangerous for her. What was that all about? And speaking of qualms, him ordering the doctor to perform a full examination on Stamos, isn't that a conflict of interest because of their relationship? So we get to see Brennan and Taylor transport to the other ship. And upon arrival, Brennan informs them that their first drop for the beacon is 600 meters in that direction. 600 meters? To put that in perspective, that's over 1/3 of a mile away, 0.37 of a mile to be exact. And they managed to make their way across the ship that distance without any encounters? Because all we saw was her telling him that it was 600 meters that way, and then they arrived at their destination. So it's like, okay. Now, I have to say, I've watched this episode twice, On my first viewing, I thought the flashbacks that Tyler was having was actually proof that he was a Klingon that had undergone some sort of treatment. And I was actually disappointed. I was like, oh, really, that they are going with this story? And I was a little disappointed. And my rating was actually dropped for this episode. But upon my second viewing of the episode, I stopped and watched all those flashback scenes in slow motion. And all I saw was him being tortured. There was no indication that he had gone under some sort of procedure to alter him, what he looks like. So I don't know anymore. Now, there was another thing I didn't quite understand about the episode. When the Discovery engaged the Klingons, we saw Discovery jumping from location to location, firing on the Klingon ship. And then when the ship finally cloaks, Lorca orders the spore jumps. Does that mean they weren't actually jumping before? Or if they were jumping, Stamos wasn't doing it because we saw him then get ready for his 130-some-whatever jumps. So how were they jumping beforehand? That one left me scratching my head. And now for my turbo lift up and turbo lift down. I only have a couple of turbo lift up that I want to share. One of them is I thought it was really cool that Discovery was able to make a spore jump while in warp drive. I thought they'd have to come out of warp, but they're on their way back to whatever, Starbase 46. And during their warp drive, they jump back to the Parvo system. So that was pretty cool. And I also just, I liked the scene with Tilly spilling the beans on Stamos. It was the only little bit we got from her this episode, but it was funny. Just, oh, I'm so glad that he finally opened up about the side effects. And it's like, what side effects? And just the exchange. I thought that was funny. Now, my turbo lift down moments, I do have a few. One is Saru. I didn't like that we had no aftermath from his actions from last episode. We're just supposed to forget that he almost mutineered kind of like Brennan did. And yet there's no repercussions. There's nothing being said about it. So I didn't appreciate that. The other thing, and this is just a small little qualm of mine. Whenever the Klingon ship decloaked and they said, okay, we can beam on board, then they walked up to the transporter platform, got ready, and then they transported them. Why weren't they already on the transporter pad ready to go the minute the ship decloaked? And my last turbo lift down moment is, this is just a beef I have. Brennan and Taylor were on a covert stealth mission. Why do the beacons that they have to install emit sounds and lights and even a voice? What did it say? Initiating connection to Discovery? Like, why does it have to say this stuff out loud if they're on a stealth mission? Even Brennan's tricorder, when she said she detected a human on board, her tricorder was making beeps and noises. You don't want something like that. They should be turned into some sort of silent or stealth mode. Same thing with that device that was on their chest that cloaked their human presence and made them look like Klingons. Why did that thing have to have a big glowing light so that if they're walking down a hallway, somebody around the corner could see this light coming ahead of them? So all those little things added up for me that for two people that were supposed to be on such a stealthy, covert mission to have so many things that could have given them away was just something I shook my head at. Anyways, that's it for my feedback. I want to thank you too for the great podcast that you are doing for Star Trek Discovery. I am loving this show and I am loving your podcast, and I can't wait to join you again for Chapter 2 of this season coming in the new year. Until then, this is Mark from Ontario, Canada, out.
I wanted to play both of those. Well, thank you, Mark, for those sentiments. We appreciate it. All right. Well, anyway, so Mark brings up, as usual, some great points in his voicemail. So let me ask you this. His first point, is this the end of the war, or is it just the beginning of the end of the war? And the other question I would have to that is, I thought that the Klingon War was 4 years long.
Yeah, those are all really good questions. This is something that we know from previous Trek canon, but there have been so many times that they've strayed from that already in this series. I don't know if we can believe that this really causes the end of the war or not. I would argue not, because just because you've lopped off the Ship of the Dead and killed the leadership doesn't mean the entire rest of the Klingon Empire is going to all of a sudden lay down arms. I mean, if anything, that's going to give them more cause to fight.
Well, for that matter, we don't really know what Laurel has is she actually defecting? Or if Tyler ends up being Vok, are they doing some plan to try to defeat the Federation from within or something like that? Is she going to turn into, you know, Lieutenant Smith?
Right.
I mean, it's possible, right? After this, you know, maybe she'll get away and then miraculously, you know, this Lieutenant Smith will show up, and Lieutenant Smith and Tyler become a couple, and he breaks up with what's her face?
Burnham.
Oh, yeah. At this
Brennan, sorry.
Yeah, Brennan. Mark. Brilliant voicemails, but come on, get their names right. You keep calling, you called him Brennan and or her Brennan, and you called him Taylor. So we're just kidding, but I couldn't help but notice it. I think I had heard you do it at least one other time, but this time you did it a lot. Anyway, sorry. Don't mean to criticize you. It's all in fun. The other question that he brought up, and I was going to comment on it, but when I heard his voicemail, that last spore jump, it's like the Discovery like splits into two, and you know, mm-hmm. like, so, do you think that is some indication of mirror universe?
I think they certainly ended up somewhere else. So there's at least one ship out of its normal place in time and space. If another one was created, we might have just seen, actually, maybe that was just kind of like an effect to really visually represent that they had jumped from one dimension to another. So you kind of got that transitional phase where it's in two places at once. Or, you know, it could be duplicated. It's really just wait and see, I guess. I hope they're not trying to follow. If there are two ships, I hope they're not going to try to follow both of them in the second half of the season, because that would get so confusing trying to keep straight, you know, which ship are we on right now kind of a thing.
It would be kind of interesting, you know, if like you went back to it and turns out that one of them was the ISS Discovery and the other one was the USS Discovery. But like I know episode 10, there's been this rumor that there is a Mirror Universe episode, and we kind of, you know, hear Lorca and Stamets talking about parallel universes. So, you know, they're certainly leading up to the fact that it could be there. Maybe the mycelial network is the gateway to them. But to that end, the question that I had with that is, I've heard some indications that Jonathan Frakes is the director. Now, when I looked it up on Wikipedia, it doesn't list him as the director. It's listed as TBD. Obviously, that isn't for sure, but I've seen other places where he is the director, and we know that supposedly he might be doing the Mirror Universe episode. We don't know, but I have heard that from multiple places. So is the next episode Mirror? Who knows? Any thoughts? Well,
he would be a great director for that kind of an episode because, you know, we got Tom Riker and William Riker. So who better to direct a possible split than the guy that actually got duplicated in a transporter beam?
And he's also proven himself many times as being a fantastic Trek director, both of TV and film. So,
sure, if you want to count those things. The man was in two places at once. He was duplicated in a transporter beam. That's my case.
Okay. Yes. Well, maybe that's why he's a very effective director, because there's two of them. Okay. I'm mixing the characters with the person in real life. Okay.
Yeah, this is what happens when we record an hour late and a day later than that.
Yeah, exactly. He does make a good point, and it was something I noted too, that they had to travel 600 meters. I mean, for one thing, how big is that ship? Holy cow. 600 meters is, it's certainly a long way, probably 1900 and something feet.
Yeah, that's a bit of a hike. I wonder why they had to travel all that way inside the ship, why they couldn't beam any closer.
that's 1,968.5 feet.
Yeah, that's a long time to be on an enemy ship and not get discovered.
It certainly is. And it would take some time to walk that amount and so many things there. So many things. What else?
That does bring up, speaking of the distance and everything and the fact that this was a stealth mission, he made a lot of good points about the lack of stealth employed in their mission there. So what was your take on all of that?
He's 100% right. You know, I think maybe on another watch, I might dock it a little bit more. Maybe, you know, some of this was emotion. But yeah, I mean, for that matter, I mean, the writers of this episode, I don't know, well, certainly their first Star Trek episodes. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, how much they've done before. But yeah, I mean, they made it's really good script, I think. But the one thing, and I'll tie it to this, you know, he also mentioned the aftermath of Saru and, or is it Saru? I guess it's Saru.
Saru.
Yeah. So Saru, you know, seemed to experience no discipline or anything else from what he did on Paavo. And, you know, going right back to the transmitter, there was seemed to be not a lot of continuity there between the things that happened on the planet and this story. So, like, it was, like you say, no ramifications. Transmitter, I still don't get it, you know, in discussing it. It almost seemed like some of the writing might have been happening outside of the writer's room, like certain TV shows, like I know X-Files, I think, was this way, where they would just go off and write the episodes, right? And then they would come back when they were done. There wasn't a lot of, like, continuity discussions because they were all, I guess, probably because they were all episodic. But it didn't seem like the Kirsten Beyer story from last week had as much to do with the Erica Lippold and Bo Young Kim, I think that's her name, their story. There's a lot of stuff that seemed to be dropped from last week.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you switch writers back and forth, maybe they don't know all the nuances of what each other's writing. Because like you said, we were praising things like Tyler's PTSD. So obviously they're calling that, that's a callback to a previous episode referencing his backstory. But now just the previous episode doesn't really seem to have a lot of bearing on this one other than, well, the transmitter is going to be the MacGuffin that gets the Klingons and the Discovery to square off again. And that's about it. There's really nothing else from the last episode that really had much, except for Saru's little speech to Lorca, trying to see if he can talk to the Admiral and, you know, make an impassioned plea because he understands the Paavo Inians or whatever we call them.
Yeah, and I didn't talk too much about this, but you were asking about the lack of stealthiness. Mute. Why did they not use mute?
Right? What were we talking about right before we went on the air? You were boasting about how easy it is to put your Galaxy S8 into airplane mode?
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, it's like all the technology in the 23rd century and there seems to be no mute.
Yeah, that's another tradition of television, though. Like everything that a computer does on a TV show has to make a noise along with it. It's never just type a key, see it on the screen. It's always, you know, programs running and you get the little like click clack sounds, all that kind of stuff.
One final thing that he bring. Oh, actually, no, there's two. He was asking about Burnham and why he didn't want Burnham to go on the mission. And my take on it is he's trying to protect her basically because she is a resource that he doesn't want to see die. Like he needs her so badly that he doesn't want to use her in a high risk situation. Even though in this case, I think that and Burnham certainly used different tactics with him versus what she did with Giorgio. You know, she gave her the Vulcan neck pinch instead of trying to convince her like she did Lorca. You know, I think this whole thing that she is too valuable to be put in a high risk away mission where there is a potential for loss of her life. That was my take. What about you? You agree with that?
I agree. That's one thing that's making me weary on the Burnham character is that there have been so many situations already in this series where she's the only one who can handle it. We've got a whole ship full of Starfleet's best and brightest, yet she is the one person who can solve all of these problems.
Well, there is one thing that she can't do. She can't fly a spore drive.
True. Not yet, at least.
That may be the only thing she can't do.
Yeah, that's the problem with the character so far, is that she keeps being thrown against challenge after challenge after challenge. And so far, apparently, the only thing she really can't do is figure out how to kiss a boy.
Yep. All right. Well, as usual, Mark, unless you do you have anything else?
No, he's so thorough. It's really hard to come up with anything that he hasn't already addressed.
Anyway. All right. Well, we've got another voicemail, and it is Fred from the Netherlands.
Hello, Brian, Adam, and listeners to the Star Trek Discovery podcast. This is Fred from the Netherlands with some feedback on episode 9. I think it was a quite nice episode, which brought a lot of storylines quite a little bit forward. I think I give this episode an 8 out of 10. Last three times I gave a 7. So this is the first 8 from me. I give it 8 interspecies sex scenes. Of course, after Jonathan Frakes, Commander Riker, and also a director of one of the future episodes, gave a little bit away that there will be a mirror-mirror-like episode, so an alternative universe. We saw that in this episode, and of course we saw that a little bit coming. As soon as Stamets said, "Just one more jump," I thought, okay, now it's going to happen. Now it's going wrong. 133 times it went well, and now it went wrong. So I saw that coming. And of course, when we go into an alternative universe, it could also be possible that we see some characters back that we already lost. When the makers did film this episode, they probably didn't know that the Me Too discussion would be going on at this time. So Taylor being tortured by Laurel is actually quite a theme that is fitting into what's happening in the real world now. Strange is that, it's a bit awkward that Laurel is saying in this episode, "I will never let them hurt you." And what did she do? When I saw the episode for the first time, I thought we saw some flashes where they did an operation on Tyler, and where he was transformed from a Klingon to a human, as also being speculated. But I did some pausing and look at frames, but you never see in all these scenes a Klingon. It's always a human together with Laurel. So is she protecting him, or is trying to protect him just because he is her favorite toy? And that's the reason why she's saying, "I will never let them hurt you," so that she can keep him and hurt him herself. One other indication for the parallel universe was when the Discovery went to in the last spore jump. You, as a fraction, you can see two ships, and then they convert together again. So that's another reason why we can expect that something like that is going to happen. But we have to wait until next year. I don't have many no's, and one yes I really liked is that Captain Lorca puts in his eye drops just before they blow up the Klingon ship, so that he can fully appreciate the blow up of the ship, and that he is not hampered by his ocular problem with too much light. I think that was a very nice detail. And if you're not paying attention to that, then you, perhaps you even think why he's taking these drops. But that's probably why. And I like this kind of detail, what they put in. Okay, that's all for now. Talk to you next year. All the best. Greetings, Fred from the Netherlands. Bye-bye.
See you next year.
It sounds strange to say it, but it's true.
Yeah. I will just comment that, not in order, but I'm glad you brought up the eye drops, Fred, because that was something that I took note of, and I really liked that because I had to remember that, you know, he didn't want to get his eyes fixed because of that it was a reminder of the Baran, and I liked that he was ready to see that Ship of the Dead blow up, and you know the light that would hurt his eyes, and he wanted to see that too, just so that he could remember that. So I thought that was really good.
Yeah, and I missed that detail entirely. So thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. One more time in a minute. What was I trying to say? Okay. Now I know what that is. Sorry about that. Well, we talked about this already, but the whole, like, you know, old cop, you know, solving his last case kind of thing, you know, just jump one more time. There is something of note that, Mari has in his feedback that we'll talk about, I think, quite a bit, but, I just wanted to note it now in Fred's feedback. Fred and, Mark brought up the whole, like, is Tyler Vok versus, you know, is Tyler just a tortured Tyler, you know, by Laurel? And one thing that I didn't mention earlier with Mark's voicemail that I had to take note of is he said that he watched those scenes in slow-mo. And I thought, God, I wish I could watch the scenes in slow-mo myself, but that's not available on CBS All Access. You can't watch the stuff in slow-mo.
Right. I don't know. Maybe he recorded it off and played it in some sort of After Effects or Final Cut or something like that. No,
I don't think he had to, because he most likely watched it on his DVR. Because in Canada, it's on Space, which is a cable channel. So.
Oh, that's right. And you can play DVR in slow-mo?
Yeah, well, certain DVRs you can. I know with our Dish DVR you can. The Hopper you can.
Oh, see, I'm a cord cutter, so I have no idea what DVR technology is like these days.
Well, even like, you know, certain ways that you can watch YouTube, you can watch stuff in slow-mo.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I wish that there's certain things on this show that I would like to be able to watch in slow-mo, but that's, you can't even do a proper rewind. And I know that was that the other, was it Rick? Oh, this is Rick. It was Mike from Cleveland, I think, that was talking about the fact that he could rewind. And I still haven't found it. So there's no slow-mo, there's no rewind that I've been able to find. But there may be on other devices.
Not yeah, the viewing experience is very different based on what country you're in. So that determines the service you're on. And then, of course, what device you're accessing it from, too.
Yeah, I mean, if you're watching it on Netflix, you can watch it with Klingon subtitles. You know, I mean, that's so cool, but, you know, that's not offered in the States, or I imagine probably not in Canada. I think that's just a Netflix thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I would assume so. Getting back to the Tyler issue, though, where are you at with that now? Do you still think that Tyler is Vok, or are you more towards Tyler is just Tyler?
I was thinking that Tyler is Tyler until the end, you know, and what she says to him that made me think that. Yeah, but there's so many questions I've got with that. If he is, I mean, how is it that they haven't detected it? You know, I mentioned a few weeks back, you know, the whole idea of a tribble. We still haven't seen that tribble. I want Tyler to go into the ready room and interact with that tribble. And once that happens, you know, I think we'll have her answer. But
yeah, the way I took it, the line from Laurel is that, you know, a lot of times, not to get too heavy in real world on this, but, you know, if the allegory and what we're seeing here is an abuse victim, a lot of times the abuser will, you know, dole out little bits of nurturing here and there and build that dependency. So I don't think just her comment about "I won't let them hurt you," I don't think that implies anything duplicitous. I think that's her manipulating him by trying to reinforce that idea that she is his protector and she's the one who's going to look after him. So he comes to her willingly.
Yeah. And it could be, you know, taken as, "I won't let them hurt you. I will hurt you myself."
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, it's a dark topic, but not to get too real world about it, but you know, I've had friends who've had relationships that weren't necessarily physically abusive or anything, but, you know, emotionally abusive relationships where the same person who does all these terrible things to them is the same person who then calls him and says, "Oh, I love you so much. And I'm the only one who can take care of you," and all these sweet things that lure the victim back to them. So that's what I picked up from it. They were going so heavy with the abuse victim angle that I thought that the line from her was just the abuser's point of view doing the manipulation.
It, you know, certainly by his reaction, you know, he is suffering, you know, from PTSD, and that it can be taken two ways. Like, if you take it on face value, it's PTSD. It is that, you know, he was coerced sexually. And if you take it at face value, you know, he has been, you know, sexually coerced. And, you know, I wanted to draw the parallel between the Negan character on The Walking Dead and, you know, Laurel and, you know, Tyler here, because there's a lot of people that treat what Negan does on The Walking Dead, like, he has many wives. And, you know, a lot of people argue the fact that, you know, they're being coerced. Like, it's, you know, either, you know, you marry me or you die, or you, you know, live a horrible life. And, you know, he has sex with them, and, you know, that it's coercion. And it may be, it may be not. I lean towards the maybe than the maybe not. So I'll buy that it is. So if you treat it that Tyler is Tyler, you know, certainly he has been raped in this, because any form of, you know, sexual coercion, whether it's, you know, forcibly raped or coercion raped, you know, like, against someone's will, that's rape. If you take it that he's Vok, then what he remembers as torture is that, you know, being turned into a human, which I imagine would have been a very painful process. And the things that he remembers as rape probably, or could have been, him actually having consensual sex with her, and as Vok. Okay. So the sex wasn't having the sex with her as, or most of it as Tyler, but instead as Vok. And, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, hopefully people won't start throwing Rotten Tomatoes at me or something. Because I'm not saying this way or that way. I'm saying that there's the potential still for it being one way or the other or somewhere in between. I want to see, regardless of it, no matter how it ends up, if Tyler is Tyler or Tyler is Vok, I want to see this story come to its conclusion, because it is really interesting to me. And it's certainly, I think, a story that is told in a modern way versus, you know, what we probably would have seen 20 years ago on Next Generation, you know, which had torture and stuff like that, but didn't have the same kind of sexual part.
Yeah, the closest thing to PTSD as I can relate it to would be Next Generation with Picard and the Borg. You know, he had that plate, that flesh-colored plate on his head for, what, all of two episodes going into the subsequent season. And then, of course, you know, First Contact, they brought it back up again. But nothing to this degree. The going back and forth on the Vok or Tyler thing, a lot of people say that because we see nothing but Tyler in all these flashbacks, that's proof that Tyler is just Tyler. And again, I'm with you. I'm not going to come down on one side or the other for sure. And that's the great thing about this series, is there's so many mysteries that are hinted at that you don't know what you can actually take on face value. But I'm with you. If Vok is unaware, if he's like a Manchurian candidate, a sleeper cell kind of thing, if he's unaware of his true nature, then all these flashbacks would still be memories as Tyler, even though they may have happened while he was Vok.
Yeah. So
I don't think the visual of the character in the flashback is necessarily indicative of who the character really is.
Yeah. And you've got an unreliable narrator, you know, so you can't trust what you've seen, because if he's Vok, he's remembering them as Tyler when the actual, you know, truth could be something completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. It could be one, it could be another. But I think it's interesting. And this is a part of the story that I really like. I know some people don't, but I do. I like it. And, you know, the whole character of Tyler is quite interesting. I do agree with you, though. We should have seen some of this PTSD before now.
Yeah, I would have liked a little bit of foreshadowing instead of having it just come up all at once. And I don't know. Maybe our listeners know more about it than I do. Maybe that's the way it happens. You think you're fine, and then all of a sudden something triggers it.
Yep. All right. Next.
Well, we're out of voicemails, correct?
We are out of voicemails.
All right. Then let's move on to some written feedback. We collected this from a couple of sources. Stefan is one of our favorite posters. He posted in our Facebook group. He says this. So just reading the title, I expected a battle down on Pavo, but it was no such thing. I was under the same idea as Maury, another listener, that I didn't think Ash Tyler was Vok until he talked with Laurel. My take is now that Ash Tyler has no idea he is Vok, and Laurel changed his appearance to become Tyler because it was the only way to save his life and hide him away in a prison cell. The show is well into changing the appearance with the altering of DNA. So Stamets will go and become examined by the experts, and then in the next episode, he will be back as a normal member of the ship. What I remember from After Trek was that the main idea was that the tardigrade was a crew member with a headset and other stuff. I guess this is a way to play out some of the original storylines that were made before they ended up doing something else. It felt too easy how they defeated the Ship of Death. They had to solve it in a way that got out the key characters while closing the chapter on this Rebel Klingon warlord. I enjoyed it overall, even if it felt like a short episode.
You felt like it was a short episode. I didn't feel like it was a short episode, so that's interesting. Too easy. What do you think about that that point that Stefan makes, that it was too easy for them to defeat the Ship of Death?
Yeah, I have to kind of agree with that now that I think about it. And they placed the beacon. Detecting the ship is one thing, but actually taking it out is another. And I thought that that happened way too easily. That thing was a formidable... I mean, it took out the Shenzhou in a straight-up battle, so how the Discovery was able to defeat it so handily.
Well, it was because the ship never decloaked, and it is a point of note, and this is, I believe that's true for the Romulan cloak as the Klingon, you know, cloak. Although, you know, we talked about this before, I think, we didn't know anything about a Klingon cloaking device before the Klingons got it, I think, in the movies. But the thing is that both Klingon and Romulan cloaking devices, they can't have shields up when the cloak's up. So that's always been a problem. So if you're able to, you know, shoot at a cloaked vessel, you know, they're going to have their shields down, and a ship with the shields down is not difficult to defeat. So I think that's what happened in the case of the Klingons. That's why it was fairly easy for them to defeat them.
Yeah, okay, that would make sense then. You're right. Shields down is a much different story.
And, you know, I don't remember who said this. But it was just something that just popped into my head. It might have been in Mark's voicemail. But the idea of how many jumps there were before the cloaking device went up. So how did they do those jumps? Because it certainly seemed like they were doing jumps before the 133 jumps. And I have to agree with that. I hadn't thought of that until you said it, Mark. And I forgot to mention it earlier. But us discussing this reminded me of that point.
I thought that once they had the beacon in place, that was their marker to jump around.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought that they had to jump around with the beacon being in place and them being cloaked. But they started jumping around before they were cloaked. At least that's what I thought.
You watched the episode a number of times, and yet still, when you really have to talk about it in detail, you start questioning what you saw.
yeah, you do.
I thought the order of events was that the ship arrived cloaked, then decloaked to make a stand, and when they decloaked, shields were down, of course. Burnham and Tyler beam aboard, and then all the rest of the sequence and the jumps started taking place. I thought the jumps didn't take place until after Burnham had placed the beacon.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm questioning myself.
Or maybe they did begin beforehand, but they didn't begin until the ship had decloaked. Because once the ship is decloaked, you can jump around it all you want. You can see it. It's you know, visible to sensors. And then once the beacon's active, it's still visible to sensors, even though it's cloaked.
And I think you said in your yeses that those mini jumps were pretty cool. I got to say, they were pretty cool.
See, it's a great battle tactic.
Well, talk about, like, you know, Berserker, you know, you got this ship spinning all over the place, like, you know, miraculously, you know, popping up, like disappearing and reappearing. And, you know, I thought it was quite effective watching their confusion. And, you know, something else that I think I was going to say in our own section, but since we're talking about this now, I might as well bring it up. I liked the fact that Lorca, he's like wondering, you know, why aren't they cloaking, or why aren't they? Yeah, I think that's what it was. Why aren't they cloaking, or why aren't they shooting, or why aren't they leaving? The reason why they weren't doing anything is because Burnham was fighting Cole.
yeah. No one was giving orders to do so.
Yeah. They were just watching him fight, you know? So I thought that was pretty cool, actually. I like that little part.
Well, I'm glad it was addressed on screen as well, because that would be my thought as I'm standing there waiting for some sort of counterattack that never comes.
Exactly. You know, you're sitting there going like, why aren't they shooting? You know, why aren't they leaving? They must be thinking you're leaving. It's like, no, they're fighting, you know, excuse me.
They're busy. Hold, please.
Yeah. Can you hold, please? All right.
So how about Maury? What did he have to say there, Brian?
Well, he had a couple things to say of note. He said, I read this theory and rewatched the last 10 minutes of episode 9. Just as Stamets enters the spore drive chamber to jump to Starbase 46, Lorca assesses the spore drive from his chair and appears to override a jump. And he includes a picture, which he had on the, in the Facebook group. There's, that picture's there. Could Lorca have sabotaged the jump to avoid Cornwell, or perhaps enter one of the areas in his map shared earlier by Stamets? And I would ask the question, if that was the case, why would he do that? Why would he want to do that? Is he from the Mirror Universe? I don't think so. I'll answer the question first. But I seems like a lot of trouble to escape Cornwell, especially when she wasn't at Starbase 46. I think they said she was at Starbase or, you know, Medical 88 or something like that. It was a different facility.
Yeah, but she still had the knowledge. And when she left the ship, she was promising to take Discovery from Lorca upon her return.
Yes.
So I don't think that had changed at all.
However, he's just about to get the Legion of Honor. So he is, and I think they said this on After Track, he is in a better position to defend himself, because he literally just, you know, captained the ship that destroyed the Klingon flagship and defeated, you know, the general of the army, Cole. I think they go by general. So, you know, the de facto leader of the Empire, I guess you could say, and his flagship. So, you know, he's done a big thing, so they might want to cut him some slack. So I don't know if Cornwell is going to be able to get him unseated without a lot of resistance from, you know, the other admirals and, you know, other Federation people.
Yeah, I agree. That's definitely one of the bits of fallout that's going to happen, as I'm guessing towards the end of the season, because wherever they're at currently is definitely not where they were. So let's get them back into, quote, normal space if they're somewhere else right now, and then deal with the ramifications of everything that was going on before they got marooned wherever they are now.
So, okay, let's ask the question. So do you think that this was all a plan by Lorca to, you know, get Stamets to, you know, do yet another jump and, you know, sabotage the jump to get away, or to end up in some kind of strange, you know, place, you know? And if that's the case, why? What's the motive there?
That's a really good question. I'm looking at the picture, the screen cap. And it's, if I'm reading the numbers right, and the picture's a little bit blurry, so maybe I'm not, but there's definitely an override. He overrides something on his control panel, but it's not jump 133. It looks like it's jump 102 or something. It's not the last one in the list. That's for sure. There's another jump lower in the display. So I'm not sure what to make of that little bit, but he definitely did something to intervene with the operation of the spore drive at some point there.
Yeah, it appears that he did. I just don't know why. And to that end, yeah, his picture is a little blurry, but if you look at the article that I posted, I think it's the, what was it? Uh, it's, What was it here? Can't find it. Ah, inverse.com. If you look at that article, there's a better picture of it near the bottom.
Okay. Yeah. He had that link in the Facebook group.
I did. That was me. I posted that link. Yeah. So what it looks like in that image, there is an override between jump 132 and 133. Now, you know, maybe the jumps start at jump zero, you know, yeah. Much like programming does, you know.
That's much clearer there.
Yeah. So, and it, you know, it says override Lorca, comma G, you know, and then it has jump 133 unknown, which, you know, you have to say. Makes you want to see the next episode.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to nitpick here. I have to. We have a podcast that runs longer than the running length of the episodes, usually by a factor of two. So clearly we nitpick. every other jump has a destination marked on it. Okay, so Lorca overrode whatever destination was plugged in, namely Starbase 46. I don't think he listed the replacement destination as unknown.
Yeah.
There should still be something there. Even if it makes no sense, it should be a specific destination of some kind.
Well, you know, just looking at this, I always thought that the two coordinates were out of 360. And looking at those, I see 071 mark 743. So I have to wonder, is that accurate? What does that mean? If it is in fact 360, but it doesn't look like it is. I don't know. I see.
Yeah, no. I'm never really sure how you would denote that, because they're moving in three dimensions. You can move 360 degrees on any one axis. Well, you've got three axes that you can interact with in this case. So I don't know how that nomenclature would work.
I don't know either. I don't know. It's like the first coordinate is always 071. So I don't know. I guess it's not worth spending a lot of time to speculate. However, I think we can speculate and interact with this next bit of feedback.
Oh boy. Okay. We're doing this, huh? All right.
As much or as little as you want.
Well, we gave the rating earlier in the show, so we're going to have to elaborate on it for all the listeners at home. This is Montefescu's feedback. If you recall from earlier in the episode, he's the one who gave the show and the series a 000 out of 555. So, Montefescu describes himself as the mad as hell trekker. So he begins. Hello, Star Trek Discovery podcasters. Mad as hell trekker Montefescu here. The Star Trek Discovery first series is in the bag, full of shit. As it concludes, I am not happy. It has been reported that CBS has paid between $5 and $8 million per episode to create this steaming manure fest. That is $45 to $72 million for 9 hours of drivel. For that kind of money, Ursula K. Le Guin, Harlan Ellison, and Joe Halderman should be writing this series, and Patty Jenkins and J.J. Abrams should be directing every expletive-laden and removed later for editing episode. On the story, so this is his first 0 out of 5. Stamets has a stroke after 133 bad drug trips. You haven't figured out the druggy angle yet? Like the Comanche Klingons coal leads? This analogy is obvious. Shame on you. The mushrooms go hiccup. Bad trip, man. A resident drug addict brain farts and the Starship Discovery arrives in an alternate universe. That is it. Throw in an away mission aboard the casket-lined Comanche Klingon ship of the departed Comanche Klingon dorks, where Michael Burnham is clumsily overwritten as the only character who can plant some Fulderoy telemeter buoys to transmit data about the cloak the Comanche Klingons use and also make Tyler a psycho PTSD victim. He's a Comanche Klingon. Yeah, they blew that reveal in the Laurel sex scenes. And rescue Admiral Cornball, Cornwell, who just happens to be the specific doctor who can diagnose Tyler as shell-shocked, but doesn't recognize a Comanche Klingon when she sees one. Grrr. That's only the first section. We're still going, people. Rotten odds and ends. If you can beam over a cockamamie away team onto a Comanche Klingon ship when it decloaks to plant a data transmitter, then you can beam over a bomb. End the Comanche Klingon problem. Now, on that point, I actually have to give him credit. That does make a lot of sense. Could have just blown the thing up if you had transporter access.
Yes, although I will say that I don't think that was the point. The point was to not to destroy the ship after, well, okay, after the fact, maybe. I guess they could have done that, but
I think their main purpose was to unravel the Klingon cloak, right?
Right, exactly. I guess he's saying that after you've beamed them away, since you were able to, you know, beam them away, you could beam a bomb on. And, you know, it's not, we don't see them beaming bombs very often, because otherwise, if you could, they would be doing a lot.
Georgiou tried it.
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, well, she beamed it. Yeah, she beamed it into a Klingon dude, a dead Klingon dude. So,
that was a great tactic, though. I really liked it.
It was, yes.
So, he gives the rate for acting, directing, and writing. That's where the 000 out of 555 comes from. I just have to ask, if you hated it that much, why did you invest 9 hours of your life watching it? I'm not a Game of Thrones fan. I gave it 3 hours before I gave up on it. I figured that was enough time of not enjoying something before I decided it wasn't worth future investment. 9 hours to hate it that much. I mean, there must have been some good points in there, I would assume. But no, apparently he doesn't like any of it. A question for you, Modifescu or Manifesto or whatever your name is. Do you like any of the other Trek series? Because I think that all the complaints that you have about the presentation of this show are magnified in the other series. We're talking about plot holes and convenient plot contrivances and poor characterization. These are all things that I think other shows have done much worse. So I would love to actually get some feedback in here if he had some positive thoughts about other series.
I am curious if Montefescu has sent this bit of feedback to multiple Star Trek Discovery podcasts, and it be a little bit of a lottery to see who actually covers it and who doesn't. Because that was the one thing I had a little bit of a, because, you know, on my Walking Dead podcast, we often see where people will submit the same feedback to multiple podcasts, and I'll hear it on someone else's podcast before our own, you know, so that's happened before. So it smells of this, that he sent this out to, like, you know, a dozen or 15 different Discovery podcasts, and that's about only half of them. So yeah, I mean, I had to wonder, you know, if you hated it this much, why did you go this far? Or was it just this one episode that you hated? But it seemed like it was a lot more than that. So, you know, I'll just say I disagree, and you're entitled to your opinion. I think a lot of times, you know, like, one thing I think I said to you, or was something I maybe said to somebody else, that I get a kick out of sometimes the variations of opinion upon, like, someone's favorite episode, maybe someone else's least favorite episode. And, you know, I see this all the time with The Walking Dead, covering that show. People will, like, give something a 10 out of 10, and someone else will give it a 6. And so it happens a lot. And I have to point it out this time, because, you know, a lot of people seem to really enjoy this episode. Some were kind of, you know, fair to middling on it. You seem to be sort of, you know, good but not great. And then we got this guy who obviously did not like this episode at all. So it's interesting. Infinite
diversity in infinite combinations.
Thank you. Thank you. I stumbled on the diversity part, but yeah, that's exactly what it is. It is just an example of how we can all look at things differently. So, but if, I'm curious if you're going to keep watching. That would be the other thing. Are you going to keep watching or are you done? I would hope, based on the fact that you're rating the show a zero, you know, I would say you should probably be done.
Yeah. At the very least, maybe let your subscription lapse a little bit. Maybe binge the rest when it's all done and then see what you think about it then. Because that's the thing, is we really don't have a complete view of this thing yet.
No. There are 6 episodes left, and a lot of things could happen in the 6 episodes, you know?
Yeah, that is one thing that I'm trying to wrap my head around as well, is we've got 9 total episodes. The first 2 were basically a prologue, so we only got 7 episodes of, at least in its original incarnation, the Federation-Klingon War. I really hope we're not done with that storyline, because if that's all we got of such a monumental piece of Star Trek lore, I feel a little shortchanged. How about you?
Yeah, and you know, there has been discussion that the next season will not, you know, cover the war, and I would have to if you go back to Deep Space Nine, the Dominion War was multiple seasons. It wasn't something that, you know, was done in a single season. It, you know, was over 3 or 4 seasons. And I would think that this, you know, if it's a 4-year war, which that could be the case, I don't know how solid that bit of the story is, whether it is 4 years or not. Because some of that could have been from novels, and I don't think all novels are considered canon. So, anyway, I don't know. But regardless, I think that it definitely, if this is the end of the war, I agree with you 100%. It is a little shortchanged. If the war is done at the end of season 1, maybe it will seem shortchanged. Maybe it won't, because we don't know what's going to happen in the next 6. Maybe it's going to take them a year to get back to, you know, Federation space from wherever it is they're at. You know, it could be like the Voyager Year from Hell episodes, you know.
Yeah.
A whole year could pass in an episode or two. So, you know, we don't know. You don't know.
And the ending of this episode could go partway to explaining why we don't see this technology used in the future, is maybe they never come back, or maybe they do come back, but basically the Federation looks at it and says, oh, we didn't realize our ships could disappear like that. Maybe we shouldn't use this as a form of propulsion after all.
Yeah. And for that matter, you know, what happens to Stamets after this, you know? That could also put, you know, the, because I don't think, based on what happened to him, I don't know if there's going to be a lot of people volunteering to, you know, drive a spore drive. Although we've certainly brought it up multiple times that there should be more than just Stamets piloting the spore drive. Like, Burnham, come on, you're smart. Why aren't you, you know, getting in a couple cycles?
Yeah, well, they say that, you know, eugenics are banned, so at least it's not allowed by Federation law, but Lorca doesn't seem like the type to let that kind of a restriction hold him back.
Yeah, well, and it seems like they know it about it, and they don't know about it. It's, so, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. But, you know, so far, we had one ship just plain blow up catastrophically. I forget what that first vessel was that was experimenting with the spore drive.
The Glenn.
Yeah. So the Glenn exploded catastrophically. And then now the Discovery has just disappeared from the universe entirely. that might be enough reason for the Federation to abandon the technology.
Yep. All right. Well, our last bit of feedback is from Rick from Cleveland, much like us. So Lorca has been tracking every jump the ship has made and identified that the mycelial network is a way to alternate universes. And the last jump, which he put the coordinates in for, were a jump not to Starbase 46, but a jump home. Lorca is not what he appears.
It's a trap!
Always got to use that. On the Tyler Vok front, what if the flashbacks are not flashbacks of torture, but of surgery, and the memories of sex between Tyler and Laurel appear non-consensual because Tyler does not know who he really is? Unfortunately, I don't think this week's developments put the Tyler Vok theory to rest, but instead introduced some skilled writing to advance the cover-up. I absolutely loved the relationship with Stamets and Culber, finding a tough balance of love, duty, and sacrifice. These guys brought tears to my eyes in the heart of battle. And I think this would be a good time to mention that this was the first gay kiss, I guess, the first, you know, male-to-male kiss on Star Trek, which, you know, as if you watch other TV, this happens a lot, but I guess it's the first in Star Trek. So,
and they got the twofer being interracial as well.
There you go. The way in which Burnham handled herself on the Ship of the Dead and wound up recovering Giorgio's badge, coupled with the rescue of the Admiral and the destruction of the Ship of the Dead, was a perfect way to wrap up the first chapter. Stamets's eyes, while not silver, my first thought was Gary Mitchell. Ah, Gary Mitchell. I hadn't thought of that, but it is reminiscent of Gary Mitchell from that. I think that's the second pilot of Star Trek. That was where No Man Has Gone Before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess there is some parallels there. I agree with you on Burnham and how she handled herself. And, you know, like I mentioned it before, that I liked seeing her at least partial redemption. I mean, she recovered Admiral Cornwell, which I think was a big deal, defeated Cole, you know, was instrumental in them being able to detect and defeat the cloaking devices. So, you know, I mean, will she get her rank back? I don't know, but I have to think that she, you know, at least in the court of public opinion, has scored some major points.
Yeah, it was rescuing an admiral will get you a long way, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's it for our feedback. So are there any other bits and pieces that we have not discussed that you want to bring up?
Well, a couple mentions have been made of the sex scene with Tyler and Laurel. And again, I don't mean to make light of this since it is being described as rape. But from other Trek series, it's always been described as Klingon sex as being an extremely violent affair to begin with. So what we're taking is non-consensual and, you know, physically violent. That might just be normal Klingon sex.
It could be just foreplay.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, we've covered that on Deep Space Nine with Jadzia and Worf, and there have been other allusions made to it throughout the Next Generation series. So what looks like violence might really just be the normal act for them. I don't know how non-consensual it was. I think this might be a Stockholm syndrome kind of situation, because he did mention in the first episode with Mudd, he did mention that he found a way to survive. He found a way to, you know, be useful. And so while he may not have wanted to necessarily, it wasn't like at the physical moment of the act that he was not complicit.
Yeah. And yeah, I agreed with, you know, the other, I think Rick had said this, you know, that I don't think that there is any definitive, you know, is he Vok? Is he Tyler from this? In fact, it just, you know, opens up other questions. And I still think it could go either way. One thing I found out, though, I wanted to mention that on IMDb, there is another Javed Iqbal. And strangely enough, that actor does not have in their IMDb any credits about being Vok, but it's the same name. I was really surprised to actually find that. I will admit I did not find this myself. I found it linked in another article. But so there is some potential evidence that Javed Iqbal is an actual person. I mean, and there have been several times when they've tried to interview Shahzad Latif, and I think Jason Isaacs, and they have said that they've met him, which, you know, could just be bull. Actors often have to lie about such things in the press,
mm-hmm.
you know. But so there is a potential there that it could actually be, you know, another actor. So I don't know. Wouldn't it be kind of funny if at the end of all this intrigue and speculation that it is another actor, that the whole thing was actually, no, it's another dude.
I would love it if it turns out that they're actually twins or somehow related.
Oh, yeah, it's his brother, or, you know, or something. Because his original last name is Iqbal. And it's actually on, it's on that way on Wikipedia again, and it mentions it. But I think it's Khalif is his middle name. Shahzad Khalif Iqbal. Not, there's no Latif. So anyway, enough of this. What else you got?
Well, the speculation on that whole front is so rampant at this point. I'm just looking forward to some sort of resolution in the show so we can just put it to bed already.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. It's just the more we talk about it, the more I just, you know, my head starts to spin because I want an answer, and all I find is, like, when I found out that there was an actual Javed Iqbal on IMDb that actually has actor credits, I'm like, oh, jeez. Like, so you can't even trust this whole thing. The whole thing could be a ruse.
You know? Yeah, well, we have only until, let's see, you did the math. You said by February 15th, the show should be wrapped for the first season. So we don't have, fortunately, that long to worry about this. I think no one's going to really worry about it until the show picks up again anyway. So we've got our time off, and hopefully the speculation does too.
Yeah. I think it's the 11th is the last episode would potentially be on the 11th. If you do the math, and the first, you know, the first of the six is on the 7th of January. It's the last episode would be on the 11th. That's assuming, you know, that they wouldn't like do something like, you know, not play an episode on the Super Bowl night or something like that.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. You never know for sure.
I could see them doing that, streaming service or not, probably not wanting to go up against the Super Bowl.
Well, here would be a question. Who has the Super Bowl this year?
That I do not know. But does it really matter, though? If it's CBS, they don't want their streaming service going against themselves. And if it's somebody else, they probably might also not want to go up against the Super Bowl anyway.
Yeah.
We shall see. I know they'd probably like to drag it out a little bit longer anyway, because it's 15 episodes is a little bit of a short run for an entire length of a season. And then they just got back to work on season two. So, you know, that's not coming down the pike for a long time.
It is NBC that has the Super Bowl this year. I looked it up.
Well, I'm sure we'll find out. Actually, I don't know. They've they haven't really announced any sort of interruptions except for the midseason break. So
right.
if they are going to preempt for the Super Bowl, they haven't announced it as such yet. So maybe they are going straight ahead with these.
Yeah.
I did have a couple more questions from this episode that didn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. So maybe you can help me out here. Dr. Culber, it seems to be that he is completely unaware of anything going on with Stamets as relates to the Spore Drive. Doesn't it seem like after his first use, he installed the cybernetic implants? You'd think that there would be a whole battery of follow-up tests to monitor what's going on with him. But it seems like Culber has no idea that there have been any side effects whatsoever. Were you confused by that too?
Not until you brought it up, but now that you have, I would have to wonder, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, with the fact that he, you know, lives with Stamets, you would think that he would have picked up, you know, some kind of side effects, and probably had done a lot of scans. And yet again, I have to bring up this whole thing. It's like, where's the CMO and why does Stamets get all of his care from Culber, who I think Fred brought up earlier, is in a potential conflict of interest there. You know, I don't get, like, where is this? Like, I had wondered where the chief engineer was until he was, till Stamets was actually identified as chief engineer on screen. But Culber has been identified as not the CMO. That was pretty clear. So where is the CMO and why is he not involved in something as serious as this? I don't get it.
Even Lorca says, go get checked out by Culber.
Yeah.
He doesn't say report to sick bay or go to the CMO. No, let Culber do it.
Yeah. You know, maybe Culber is the CMO now. Maybe the CMO got killed on some piece of, cut footage or something. You know, I doubt that, but I guess that's always possible. So that is something that I wish that they would explain.
Yeah, I want to know more about that as well. The absence of we've had nurses on shows before, but it's always been the chief medical officer that we've followed as far as the medical contingent, hasn't it?
Yeah, we have seen other doctors on board, like Dr. Salar, if you remember on Next Gen. Mm-hmm. So there have been other, you know, doctors on ship. But we've always followed the chief medical officer, not, you know, one of the lower, you know, less ranked medical doctors or whatever.
Yeah.
Is there more than just, well, I don't think so, an assistant ship's counselor or something like that in Next Gen? Obviously, I don't think they have counselors in this era. But, yeah, it is something that I have to ask because we have, you know, this was pitched earlier on as, you know, kind of a Lower Decks series, and with the exception of Burnham and Tilly, for the most part, we are seeing senior officers, but we're not seeing the CMO. So it's kind of strange.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that you had brought up is how Burnham actually, you know, had a discussion and got Lorca's blessing to go over to the Klingon ship instead of simply disobeying orders like she did back on the Shenzhou, which is a good growth for the character. But at the same time, he's the captain and he's kind of he doesn't take back talk well. And yet she's able to openly question his orders. She doesn't even have a rank and she's able to openly question his orders and present alternatives in front of the entire bridge crew. I thought that was kind of strange.
That's a good point. I think that in many ways, I think Lorca doesn't give her a rank because he can't. I think if he could, you know, he'd probably give Burnham like, a lieutenant commander rank back or something like that. You know, wouldn't replace Saru as first officer, but would certainly, you know, give her a high ranking point in the chain of command. But he can't. And in many ways, I think you mentioned this. The fact that she doesn't have rank actually makes her kind of valuable, because she can kind of operate outside the chain of command in some ways. She's not like burdened by rank.
She's not bound by the chain of command because she doesn't hold a rank. So a lot of the restrictions placed upon officers don't apply to her.
She's almost like, the equivalent, not exactly the equivalent, because obviously she is an inmate, or, certainly has a life sentence, but in some ways like a military contractor.
Yeah. Actually, the word I was going to use was conscript, because when she was picked up off the prison shuttle, and this must just show the growth of the relationship between the characters. She had all kinds of things she wanted to say and do, and ideas about whether or not she should even be on the ship when she first came on board. And he basically said, "You have no say in the matter. You're a prisoner and I get to do with you as I see fit." And yet now here he is reevaluating his orders based on what she tells him.
And something else too, there were a couple of glances, between Saru and Burnham, when she comes back with from the ship and, has Giorgio's badge, stuff like that. Just subtle looks I appreciated. Which is kind of funny, because he was disobeying orders himself last episode. I think I mentioned it before. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. But I thought that Lorca was very correct in making sure that Stamets is the one that gets the Legion of Honor, because given all that he's done, he certainly deserves it. I mean, we have questioned about the whole thing. Why aren't there more pilots, with the eugenics or whatever, getting the tardigrade DNA? But if you set that question aside, I mean, the guy has put himself on the line in ways that we've seldom ever seen any Federation officer do. I mean, he certainly, not what you would call conventionally brave, but certainly for driving the spore drive and the physical discomfort and changes that he's undergoing, very, very much. And considering, what they've been able to do with Discovery since he's piloted it, he deserves every commendation that he could get.
Yeah, I thought that was a good moment of chivalry and a little bit of redemption for Lorca as well, because as duplicitous as he can seem at times and all the shady practices going on, I think that was a genuine moment where he wasn't manipulating Stamets in any way by giving that to him. I think he genuinely believed that he deserved the accolade.
All right. Looking at the recording time, the stuff at the end underneath the image, I think we should just cut. If we do have a roundtable episode, we can talk about those things then.
Yeah, we're already 2 hours in.
I know. All right, so that is it for our discussion. The one thing I will point out, though, is the occasional spot the 47. Maury actually found a 47 in this episode, and it was seen on display, viewed by Stamets just before entering the spore drive chamber. There's a bunch of numbers that we see, and one of them in the on the left, sort of in the middle, is a 47, pretty clear. So,
yep, good eyeball there, Maury.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it. But to submit your feedback to us, go to, well, there are many different ways. One way is to go to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. That's typically how we've been getting our voicemails. But you can actually submit text, as did Rick and what's his name there, Montefescu, this episode. But you can submit text there. You can submit audio. There's a SpeakPipe widget which you can use as well to submit feedback to us. There's a voicemail 304-837-2278. You can send us feedback through our Gmail, which is StarTrekGSM@gmail.com. You can send us tweets at StarTrekGSM. But the best way, and most of the feedback that we get, most of the interaction that we get with you guys, is through our Facebook group, which is at facebook.com/groups/StarTrekDiscoveryPodcast. It's going to be a long time before next episode. Of course, that's on January 7th in the States and Canada. But for that episode, feedback will be back on a Monday night by then. So the feedback. Yeah, excuse me. The feedback will be due 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 Central on that Monday after the episode has aired. One of the best ways to support us, if you want to support us, is to share when we post stuff on Facebook and Twitter. Share it, retweet. That helps, you know, get more people to know about us and when the episode goes out. If you have somebody that's watching Discovery, tell them about us as well. I think a lot of people actually will be picking up Discovery over the hiatus, because you know, a lot of people will decide now that the first 9 have been aired that, you know, it's a good time to binge watch the first 9. So if you got some friends that are picking up the show, good time to tell them about the podcast. Go to goldenspiralmedia.com/apple. to find us on Apple Podcasts. That's a quick way to get there. And you can leave us a rating or review to help get the word out and help, you know, get us noticed by other people looking for the many Star Trek podcasts that are out there. Subscribe on whatever podcast client that you use. That'll make sure you get the next episode. We don't have any new reviews this week, but, you know, hopefully over the hiatus, we'll get quite a few. Who knows? Hopefully, over the hiatus, we will work on the Patreon. I know Adam and I will discuss that and try to figure out what we will offer for that. I have some ideas. Support the network, though. Go to goldenspiralmedia.com/support for the various different ways. The next episode is season 1, episode 10, which is Despite Yourself, is titled.
And it's written by my favorite author, TBD.
Yep.
Also directed by TBD.
And although some sources claim that is directed by Jonathan Frakes, so we will see. We know he is one of the 6 directors or 6 episodes. One of them is directed by him. So, all right. Well, unless you have anything else.
Well, I'd just like to take a quick moment.
Okay.
And thank our audience for being with us on this journey so far. It's been a lot of fun. We've got some weeks off now. So because we won't be back before the new year with a new episode review, I just want to wish everybody in the States and otherwise a happy Thanksgiving, a Merry Christmas if that's your holiday, Happy Hanukkah, any celebration you may have coming up throughout the end of the year, and of course a very safe and happy new year as well. It's been a blast so far, and looking forward to what's yet to come.
Yeah, and it's been a blast working with you, Adam, covering this show. Really enjoying it so far. Really enjoying listening or hearing from you guys. Mark, what could be said about your voicemails? They're so awesome. And, you know, we'll be back certainly in January. Definitely going to be off for the next several weeks. because I'm going to be busy with some other stuff right now. So it'll be a while for sure, but we'll be back for sure in January, maybe earlier. And to that end, I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
Peace and long life.
And live long and prosper.